Called disgraceful, third-rate, and not nice by Donald Trump, NBC News correspondent Katie Turr reported on and took flack from the most captivating and volatile presidential candidate in American history. She lived out of a suitcase for a year and a half following Trump around the country. She visited 40 states with the candidate, made more than 3,800 live television reports, and now has written a New York Times bestselling book all about it. It is entitled Unbelievable, My Front Row Seat to the Craziest Campaign in American History. Katie Turr is a correspondent for NBC News and an anchor for MSNBC. She's a recipient of a 2017 Walter Cronkite Award for Excellence in Journalism, and she is the 2018 Mona Sherman Memorial Speaker presented by the Osher Lifelong Learning Institute at Berkshire Community College. She will be speaking tonight at 6 o'clock at the Mahawi in Great Barrington, and it's a great pleasure to welcome her to the roundtable this morning. What a great pleasure. Thank you very much for being with us.
Joe, it is wonderful to be here.
Very nice to have you on the program. I'm a huge fan of this book. I was going to tell you I read it twice, and then I realized I've actually read it three times because I read it twice, and then I listened to your book on tape. So, and hearing you read it, I got a whole new appreciation of your snarkiness, which I I greatly enjoyed, I have to say.
I will take that as a compliment. Thank you.
No, I meant it as a compliment. Yes, good. I'm glad you take it that way. This is, my God, what a story. Here's the thing that I was thinking about as I was thinking again and reading the book again. Unbelievable is the title. And here we are a year and a half into this administration, and it all still seems unbelievable.
It's like, I was looking for a stronger word than unbelievable. I mean, It is, even though a lot of the behavior now is believable because we've seen it, so much of it for the past few years, it's still unbelievable that we're at this point. And I find myself sometimes waking up and wondering, is this real life? And then I go back to the campaign. I remember everything that happened then. And I think, yes, no, it is real life. This is the world we're living in right now. This is the presidency we have right now. These are the new norms. And this is what it's going to be like for the next 2, maybe 6 years.
You have covered campaigns before, of course. And so once you...
Actually, I had not. This is my very first campaign.
Your very first campaign ever? I mean, not non-presidential?
It was my very first, like, full-on, start-to-finish political campaign.
My understanding is most of the times after you've done it, you get to, you know, you move on. But what strikes me about this campaign is that because of the investigations, because of what's talking, it seems as every day the headlines on your show and others are about the 2016 campaign.
Yeah, it's like we're frozen in time. It's like we're a watch and a blast. We are still litigating in many ways what happened in 2016 because there are still so many very serious open questions about it. How much was Russia involved? And was there anybody working on Donald Trump's campaign that was coordinating with Russia or potentially somebody else? Why was the WikiLeaks, why were those emails released when they were released? Why did they stop the day that Donald Trump got elected? Was this just them working entirely on their own? Is it that much of a coincidence? Who knows? What did the FBI know about the campaign before the American public did? Why did the American public not know about it? Why does the president believe he was being spied on? I mean, we are still living in 2016 because there are still so many questions about how this reality TV show host, this New York real estate magnate, this tabloid fixture became president and why he was so appealing to the 40% of Americans who decided that they wanted to take a chance on him.
Do you find yourself looking back at times during the campaign and now with the pleasure, and I use that word loosely, the pleasure of hindsight of saying, oh, okay, well, maybe that was going on that particular day? Because we're looking at very specific days, times, and hours in the campaign that allows you to sort of add things up differently than perhaps you did at the time?
Well, I mean, I think what's really interesting is that it seems like all of the events that we're learning about that investigators were interested in are all surrounding a six-week period in the summer of 2016. This is in the lead up to the nomination, the convention, and in the aftermath of the convention as they were gearing up for the general election. A lot of talk about that July 27th news conference where, you know, he looked at cameras and he said, "Russia, if you're listening, I was at that news conference. At that moment, I felt like that was a very strange thing to say, and I pushed him on it at that moment. I was standing outside of Trump Tower the day that Donald Trump Jr. and Paul Manafort and Jared Kushner had that meeting with that Russian lawyer." All of these things were going on as I was there covering it. And while a lot of them were happening behind closed doors and they were faces that I wouldn't recognize, I'm still struck by how secret, how much of a secret it was, and how the FBI was able to have an informant or a source talk to people in the campaign, or they were interested and they were investigating it and there were red flags raised, and how we didn't know anything about it. I mean, that to me is remarkable. When Donald Trump says that it was a political effort by the FBI to do damage to him, it makes me wonder, if it was a political effort, why didn't reporters know anything about it? Why were we not hearing leaks about it and talking about it in the lead up to the election?
You mentioned leaks, and I find it interesting because there were, certainly in the early days of the administration, and of course we're still hearing now, of his concern about leaks in the White House. Was it a campaign that leaked as well?
I had a lot of sources in the campaign and a lot of source reporting, let's put it that way.
Okay. So the information you could get, you felt you could get the information most times that you wanted to get.
I mean, yes and no. There were certain people in the campaign who were willing to tell you about what was going on behind the scenes and the way it was functioning, and you know, hand out information that wasn't official yet. And there were some sources who would hand it to you because they were trying to strategically place things. Usually that wasn't to me because they were going to more friendly, quote unquote, friendly outfits, places that wouldn't ask too many questions. But there were others that just wouldn't talk, period, to the press. It was a mixed bag. But what we noticed in the campaign, or what I found in the campaign that's being mirrored in the White House, is that everybody who does talk, it feels like they're all out for themselves. And there's this Hunger Games atmosphere within the campaign and now within the administration, where everybody is trying to sink the other person. If it's not me that's going to get killed, I'm going to kill you. And I use that as a euphemism, not as a literal
right.
Analogy. But the infighting is all very, it's all about the individuals rather than about the collective good of what the campaign was trying to achieve or what this administration may be trying to achieve.
Did you have a sense at the time that, and I know everyone talks about this, of course, but did you see changes within the day-to-day actions of the campaign events that you said, okay, we really have to watch this? Everyone else in the world is saying that this guy is going to lose the election, but I'm here to tell you, because I'm with him every moment of every day, that may not be the case.
Oh, absolutely. And I wish you could have heard me in our morning editorial meetings with me and the entire network. You know, I would get on the phone and I would say, you know, I know it's a really big deal today. We're talking about Judge Curiel and we're talking about Alicia Machado and we're talking about him fighting with the Pope and we're talking about the way that he's addressing Hillary Clinton, saying that she isn't fit for office or doesn't have the presidential look or doesn't have the strength and stamina, or any of the number of things that caused so much controversy and outrage during the campaign. And I would get on the phone and I would say, because I was never in the office, I was always in the field, voters who are showing up to these events don't care. They don't care. They don't care at all. They don't care. They don't care. They don't care. They don't care. And it's not just the people at the rallies. They're taxi drivers that I was talking to in towns across America. There were people that I sat next to on planes folks at the gas station, folks at diners, people didn't care. They didn't care what he was saying. If they wanted to like Donald Trump, they were going to justify their affinity for him no matter what, and they were going to tune us out as just noise.
So do you buy the fire and fury narrative that the win surprised everybody in the campaign, especially the president?
It did. It definitely did. There were some people in the campaign who thought that they had a better chance than others, but then there were a number of campaign staffers who had rented their vacation homes and had planned to go to them for the next few months while figuring out their next move. The president did not think that he was going to win. Their internal polling did not show them as winning. Kellyanne Conway was on MSNBC at 5:45 the day of the election, blaming the RNC, blaming the Republican Party for not supporting Donald Trump enough. This was a big surprise to them. It was less of a surprise to me and some of the reporters in the field because we were the ones talking to the voters every day. Yeah, the campaign was interacting to a degree, but Donald Trump was on a stage and he was you know, yelling to a crowd. We were the ones that were out in the towns all the time. We were the ones seeing that groundswell. And while the polls didn't look good and while the political gravity should have been against him if you use all the what had been the traditional rules of politics, there was something in the ether that wasn't going away and that would nag at your shoulder and say, hey, you know, this guy's got a real chance. And people may tell pollsters one thing, but once they get into that voting booth, there's a way to understand a desire for them to just say, hey, screw it. I want to see things change. And maybe this isn't the best option, but it's the only option I see.
So when Donald Trump was on that stage and he was yelling at the audience, just days before the election, he said, Katie, you're not reporting it, Katie, but there's something happening, Katie. There's something happening. So you knew that, and even though, and that really turned the crowd, I guess, at that moment against you. But what is, two questions. One, what is it like to be called out? It wasn't the first time, but what was it like for you to be called out like that? And then the second, I mean, did you really take him at his word and say, oh, okay, there is something happening here?
I mean, well, I knew that there was something happening because I had been reporting on it. So when he was saying that, what he's doing is he's, you know, he was using me as a foil. He used the press as a foil in order to galvanize his supporters. So there's something happening. We're not reporting it. He isn't watching our reporting. He has no idea. But he's using us and saying that we aren't in order to say that we are out to get him. And we are out to try and bury this groundswell of support. And we're a bunch of liars. And you guys know the real truth. I mean, that's how he used us. I mean, there were times where he would say just absurd things like the cameras won't show the crowds and like everyone will turn around us at boo and the cameras are turned around all over the crowd looking at everybody booing. They're pointed in you know, six different directions. But there's one camera in the middle that never stays off him. He understands how it works. He understands the production. But it doesn't matter. It's all about the messaging. The facts don't matter. The messaging is what matters more. So that's why he would use us. Your second question, what is it like to be called out in a crowd? It's surreal. I mean, it's weird. It's weird to have a few thousand people turn around and boo you. It's uncomfortable. It's probably one of those things that I didn't fully appreciate at the moment, and I'll look back on in 10 years and try to grasp, try to get my mind around.
So as you'll be speaking tonight at the Mehewi for this Mona Sherman Memorial Lecture, what when you talk, and with 2 years past almost, what is it that you like to tell crowds and explain about this story?
I like to tell people not to paint with a broad brush. I think it. It's very loud out there right now, especially if you're on social media, where people are just calling each other names on both sides. And that word, even you say both sides, and everyone starts screaming at you. It's not both sides. And not to equate the two, but I do think that there's more to Donald Trump's support than race and than immigration, than sexism, than xenophobia. There are elements of that 100%. I would never deny it, and I've had people tell it to me to my face. But there's a general frustration, a general hopelessness that contributed to his win that is not fully appreciated. And I think that right now people still aren't appreciating it the same way they did in 2016. So if you really don't want Donald Trump to get elected again, you're just repeating yourself. You're allowing the same circumstances to replay. So I try to say, if you really want to understand what happened and if you want to try to change it, then I would say, listen. And if you're a Donald Trump supporter, I would say, take everything you hear with a grain of salt and really consider whose benefits the president is working for. Is it yours? Is your life getting better? Or is this all about him putting on a certain show? There's a real question there because he doesn't adhere to facts. He doesn't hew to facts. For him, it seems to be much more about the way he is perceived and the way that he can take advantage of a situation. And I think that watching this investigation is very important. I mean, be ready for both outcomes. Be ready for an outcome where they, you know, Mueller's team does find some really serious crimes, and be ready for an outcome where Mueller's team does not find some very serious crimes.
Do you think that the narrative often is that, of course, that the Republicans are in great disarray, which I assume is true. There's certainly deep divisions within the party, and yet they're still in power in the House, the Senate, and the White House. But let's talk about the Democrats for a second. Are they listening? Are the Democratic leaders, in your opinion, as a journalist watching this, do you feel that they are listening and hearing, or are they perhaps guilty of this as well, of perhaps doomed to repeat because they're not listening?
Well, I think it's a mixed bag. Democratic leadership doesn't want to be talking about impeachment because they don't think voters are voting on impeachment. But there's a strong contingent of the progressive base that says we need to impeach at all costs. We being them, not me. And then if you look at some of the candidates that the DCCC has endorsed, they're not the ones who have won, not all the time, but in some cases. So it depends on where you are. They've had a lot of success in these special elections. The primary voter turnout has been positive. I think it's a little too early to condemn the Democrats for not listening or to celebrate them for listening. I just don't quite know yet. It's going to depend on how the races shake out a little bit closer to the election this year, the midterms.
Given that you are not out on the trail like you were in 2016, but do you see an anger building? I mean, just on what you were talking about of what we're seeing in these early primaries, that there is an anger out there against the president and what is happening, and perhaps the Republicans as a whole, or do you sense that we're just too early and we don't know yet?
I think it's too early. I don't know. You know, and there's you got to look at how he won. He had a very small margin of error. While he could totally win again, we're still very far off from 2020. And the reason he won was because a few more independents voted for him, a few more soft Democrats voted for him, a few more moderate Republicans voted for him. He doesn't have a lot of wiggle room. So even if a small portion of people are upset at him, a small portion of his voters are upset at him for the way things have gone, I mean, that could be enough to do him in. He's got to find some more support. I don't know if he has found more support.
As you were writing the book, did you ask yourself the question of why me? Why was I singled out? Why was I the one that became sort of the press was derided generally, but why was I the one who was taken out as the bad girl and all this?
Well, who knows? I can't get into Donald Trump's head, but I can tell you this. I mean, I was the first one to really seriously cover him and cover him full time. He might have known me from my days in local news. I'm not sure. I've been told by people close to him that he respected me, and I think maybe he liked my chutzpah. Who knows?
Yeah.
But I was always there. So in the months where nobody was following him and the Republican Party called him a joke and the political establishment said, oh, he's never going to make it to the debates. He'll never make it, past the winter break. Oh, Iowa's never going to vote for him. And oh, New Hampshire won't ever vote for him, blah, blah, blah. I was consistently there. I was always in the crowd. So when he would come back and do a gaggle with reporters or come talk to reporters, the only familiar face was mine for months and months and months and months. So he got to know me better than anybody else. I was also working for NBC News, and this is a company that he had worked for.
Right.
You know, he had his show, so I think I was just a little bit more visible. There are probably some other aspects at play.
Final question, and I'll let you go and make your way here to the Berkshires. But and that is, do you look at this? I mean, you can look at this and say, what you experienced and what you went through is that just something of incredible value that you wouldn't trade for anything?
Yeah, I got into this business to report the news, to do journalism, to see history. This is all of those things.
You certainly got to see that.
Yeah.
Katie Turr will be the 2018 Mona Sherman Memorial Speaker this year, presented by OLLI, the Osher Lifelong Learning Institute at Berkshire Community College. Turr will speak this evening at 6 o'clock at the Mehewi in Great Barrington. The event has a wait list. You can find out more by going to mehewi.org. Katie's new book is Unbelievable, My Front Row Seat to the Craziest Campaign in American History. It is published by Day Street. Katie Turr, I'm a great fan. I thank you very much for spending the time, for writing a beautiful book, and we look forward to having you in the region.
Thanks for reading and listening.
Thank you very much. Be well.
Bye.
Again, Katie Turr will be at the Mehewi tonight at 6 o'clock as part of the Osher Lifelong Learning Institute's Mona Sherman Memorial Speaker. The book is Unbelievable. You can find out more about the event by going to mehewi.org. You're listening to The Roundtable on WAMC.